I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
We got a big show today. We got Mr. Mark DiCarlo. He's an actor, author. He's a three-time Emmy winner. He is the owner of Disruption Studios, Boffo the Bear, and you can check that out on YouTube for now, and then it'll be coming to streaming networks sometime soon. And he also wrote, produced, and starred in Pinocchio, and that'll be out later this year. Mark DiCarlo, how are you, man?
Hey, Mikey, good to talk to you, man.
So good to have you on. How you been doing during the pandemic?
You know what? I got no complaints. We've been busy making cartoons. Luckily, all the live action stuff in Hollywood shut down pretty much completely and is just starting to get going again. But because of technology now, we've been able to continue doing cartoons in a variety of different formats with everybody working at home. I've had enough Zooms for a lifetime. compared with the rest of the world, we got no complaints here. No complaints at all.
That's great. You started out doing the acting stuff, and now you've been doing a lot of voiceovers, like Jimmy Neutron, Handy Manny, Johnny Bravo. How did you get into all the voice acting stuff?
I graduated from UCLA, and I started doing stand-up comedy, and then I started my own improv group out here in Los Angeles. I'm originally from Chicago. And then the Second City opened up a theater here in LA, and I was one of the founding members of that cast, along with Ryan Stiles and Brad Sherwood from Whose Lies in Anyway, Andrea Mart, comedy goddess, Rich Kind, Colin Mockery, bunch of really cool people, Andy Dick, Megan Cavanaugh, who plays my cartoon mom. And, when you're doing improv, you have to do a lot of different characters in one 90-minute show. And some producers saw me and liked some of my characters, and you auditioned for a few things. And then I started getting hired, which is fantastic. The most fun you can have in acting is voiceovers, in my opinion, because in one second you could be playing a fat ditch digger, and the next you're playing a foppish king. It's all without shaving or changing your clothes. It's the best.
Can you do it from your house, or do you have to go into the studio to do it?
Typically, we always go into the studio and do. I like recording with the rest of the cast. That's how we did Jimmy Neutron. That's how we recorded Pinocchio. But in the last year, everyone's been recording remotely from their own houses. So most of the top flight voice actors in town have a broadcast quality studio in their house, and then we just technologically we link it all together, and we're able to hear each other and react off each other. And then you record it that way. Or sometimes you just record with the director, and then the director pieces it all together.
That's crazy how they can do that now.
Yeah, it's really been, there's been a lot of changes and accommodations because of the pandemic. Some of them good, some of them, were out of necessity. But I think anytime you're doing comedy, especially, it's always best to have all the cast together and listening and reacting to each other, as opposed to just reading by yourself and then letting them piece it together later.
Right. Yeah. I imagine that part would be tough. Are they going to stay that way, or are you guys going to be going back to the studio?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows. I think a lot of the economies of the pandemic will probably persist, if people can do it. There's the Chevy version and there's the Cadillac version, and the Cadillac version is having everybody in there together, but it's more difficult to clear everyone's schedule so that they can all be there on a Friday at 1:00. The results are always better. But certainly there's now a variety of different ways to approach a project, especially an animated project, now than there were, a year and a half ago.
You said you're from Chicago. Is that where you started doing stand-up and improv?
Yeah. I grew up there, and I went to high school there and started doing comedy when I was in high school, and then came out to Los Angeles because I wanted to get into show business and started doing stand-up here. My last real job was working as an intern for the 84 Olympics in Los Angeles. I haven't really had a real job. My best friend in high school's older brother and sister were stars at the Second City Theater in Chicago, and we would sneak in as 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds to watch the shows. And once I found out that, man, you can make money and just be funny 6 nights a week, that's really all I ever wanted to do.
The Second City is the legendary improv group. And I mean, tons come from SNL. Like everybody, it seems like everybody that plays there turns out to be a big star.
Yeah. Well, not everybody, but most, it's great training. And it's the Harvard of comedy.
You
learn how to act, you learn how to direct, you learn how to write, you learn how to work well with others, which is key, especially in comedy. And it's a really great training program. And everyone that comes out of there is kind of schooled in the same rules. You know, when you're dealing with improv, it's always, you never deny anything on stage. If someone, it's always yes and. If someone says, oh, wow, you've got a head that looks like a pumpkin, you don't say, no, it doesn't. You say, yeah, well, you know, I was born on October 31st and I've got a candle inside my brain. Right. So you, it forces you to move the ball forward as opposed to stopping the scene dead in its tracks. And great proving ground and a great learning experience. And, you know, some of my best friends are people that I met through that.
Wow. Still to this day. I imagine that probably helps when you're shooting movies. Do you improv a lot of your lines?
I do. Some directors like that. Some don't. You know, some writer directors want you to read their script exactly as it was written. And, you know, if that's what they want, that's what you do. Me personally, I always like it when someone throws in something a little extra because it forces you to really be in the moment and forces you to really listen and pay attention. And it's funny, you know, if sometimes you're on set, you're doing a scene five times. If it's exactly the same all five times, it's kind of hard to make it seem like it's all fresh and real. But if someone right. throws in a little something extra, it makes it interesting. I, you know, Charles Grodin just passed away last week, who I thought was one of the super funny people in movies. And I was reading an article about how he improvised on the set of Midnight Run with Robert De Niro just to get De Niro to loosen up.
Oh,
and he would throw in a bunch of lines that, and a lot of them ended up in the movies. One of the lines that they singled out in the article as an improv, he goes, you ever had sex with an animal, Jack? And you could see De Niro kind of chuckle on screen, but they left it in because it works for the character, you know? That's a funny movie.
Oh, I don't know if I've ever even seen it.
Oh, my God. De Niro and Charles Grodin and Dennis Franz, or not, no, not Dennis Franz. He passed away, too, from Chicago. All the names are escaping me right now. But it's a great cast, written by the same guy that wrote The In-Laws with Alan Arkin and Peter Falk, which is another hilarious movie. People don't talk about enough, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, they're a little bit older, aren't they? Wow. I think I've seen The In-Laws, but it would have been, I mean, a million years ago when I saw it.
Oh, yeah. The In-Laws is like 79, I think. And Midnight Run, I think, was 88. Dennis Farina, the bad guy in Midnight Run. And he's really funny. And Joe Pantoliano is the bail bondsman in that movie. Great. If you haven't seen it, you're in for a treat because it's one of the first comedies that De Niro did. And it was really funny.
Oh, I think he's very underrated as a comedic actor. He is really funny.
Yeah. And you know what? I think comedy is much harder, in my opinion, than drama, because any decent actor can make people cry with a sad story, but to make people laugh, it requires timing and a whole bag of tricks that some great dramatic actors just can't be funny. But every comedic actor, I think, can do dramatic stuff. Look at the jewelry movie that Adam Sandler did. Stolen Gems, I think that was the name of it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I think the comedic actors are better and they have better range.
Yeah, I think I'm also a musician, and I think there's a musicality to comedy and the rhythm and the timing of a joke or of a funny scene. You kind of learn to internalize as you're kind of coming up and learning your chops. And for whatever reason, you can take a scene and in the edit bay, you chop out a half a second here, a half a second there. It makes it 10 times more funny.
Yeah.
It's all about timing and the rhythm of the scene.
Right.
Just like music, I think, anyway.
Right. Do you ever go back and do any improv or stand-up or anything?
Yeah, well, you know, not in the last year and a half, but yes, right. We used to, there's a bunch of us Chicagoans here, Second City people, that used to get together every Thursday night at a really cool theater on the Santa Monica Pier called the Ash Grove, and we would do a big improv jam. We'd get about 30 of us together. We'd split up into four groups, and we'd each do like a half-hour set, and then a big tag freeze at the end. And we have, you know, Steve Carell and Nia Vardalos and Susan Nakamura and all the Second City people that are out here working right now, Kate Flannery from The Office. And we get together and just goof off. And we're talking about starting that up again now. I think just because people want to get out of their house, you know,
right.
and have a little fun. And there are a couple of rooftop comedy venues that are opening up here in Los Angeles, and they've reached out to us. So we may start again. I would love to. It's like, you know, it's like playing pickup basketball or pickup hockey. You know, you hang out with your friends, you get together, you keep yourself sharp and hang out and make people laugh. People need to laugh, especially now. Eh?
Boy, no kidding. I heard your wife actually does the voice stuff too. And she worked on the Biden campaign, right?
Yes. My wife, Yenny Alvarez, was the Spanish voice of the Biden campaign. So if you heard a Spanish ad for Joe Biden and you voted for him, you can thank her. She also is the voice of the trams at every Disneyland property around the world. Whoa. In Spanish, that tells you, you know, keep your arms and hands. So if you're a person that speaks Spanish and you have all your limbs, you owe her a debt of gratitude. Otherwise, you'd be not as functional.
Right. How does she come about being the voice of the Biden campaign?
She had her own Spanish language sitcom. Weird thing is, I was doing a late night talk show for FX from like 1998 to 2001, 2002, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. At the studio called Hollywood Center Studio, she was doing a sitcom called Los Beltran on the same lot, a couple stages over, but we never met until years later.
No kidding.
So she was a big, yeah, she came out of Miami. She had a TV show there. She moved here on her very first audition in LA. She booked this sitcom that was on for a couple years. Then she did a bunch of other acting stuff. And then she realized that she could only play the EMT or the prostitute so many times and started doing voiceovers. And again, it's much more versatile and you could do five voiceover gigs in a day, whereas if you're working on a real set, you can only do one gig. So she's really, really good at it. We have a broadcast studio. We have two of them. I'm in one of them right now, and there's another one upstairs. We have two broadcast studios here in the house, so we can all. She's been working nonstop through this whole pandemic, has, you know, she works in her pajamas.
Oh. That's the dream, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like doing a podcast. No one knows what you're wearing, or you can just be comfortable and there's no traffic BS. You can just stay in the house and do it. Although I'm itching to get out in front of a live audience again and just travel again. You know, I had a travel show on the Travel Channel for five years and loved traveling. So we're looking to do, get back to that. I've done stand up in Utah too, in Salt Lake City, with our mutual friend John Moyer. What was the name of the Uncle Somethings, or what's the big comedy club there?
There's a Wise Guys. There's a Johnny B's.
Might have been Wise Guys actually, and I found it really interesting because there were Mormons and non-Mormons in the audience, but I think it was predominantly Mormons in the audience.
Yeah,
and I was warned you have to be really, really, really clean, mm-hmm. which. I'm not really a dirty comedian, but you know, you got to watch your language and everything.
You second guess yourself, don't you, when they tell you that, even though you're not dirty?
Totally. Right. So I'm going through my material, and I do a lot of improvising in my act, and I would say something that I thought was funny, and I would kind of see everyone kind of look around, and if as long as one person laughed, then they would all laugh, but no one wanted to be the first person to laugh, especially at the racier material. It was. Super interesting. It was much more fun to watch the audience than to do the job.
Right.
It was really, really interesting. Because none of the Mormons wanted to be seen laughing at anything that was even remotely off color. Right. Yet they all thought it was funny. It was really, really interesting.
That's such a good observation. Like, that is a perfect way to describe how a lot of the audiences go here. Oh my gosh.
Have you noticed the same thing?
Yes. Yes. But once you get them, you got them, and they'll be on your side.
Oh, great, great audiences. But the first 10 minutes they were kind of like, is it okay to laugh? It's like going to like a strip club with your father-in-law. You just don't want to be there and you don't want to enjoy yourself. But you know, if the girl's hanging upside down from a pole and spinning at 360 degrees, you gotta at least applaud.
You got to give it up a little bit, right?
Little bit.
Oh my gosh. You also starred in our mutual friend John Moyer's movie, Mobsters and Mormons. Is that when you did the stand up here? You guys filmed here, right?
We did film there. Yes, I think so. Because I had shot some episodes of my travel show there in Salt Lake City. And then we came back. I was there for a couple of weeks shooting the movie. And then I think I came back again to do stand up again. The girl that plays my wife, Jeanette Puhich, lives in Salt Lake City. And she used to be the girlfriend of my cameraman on the Travel Channel show. It was like old home week.
No way.
Yeah. It was very, small world.
No, but
yeah, I think I did two clubs there. Is there one in Lehigh too?
There's not. There's one in Provo, which is right below Lehigh. And that one's the Johnny B's.
Provo.
One, right.
Okay. I think I did Provo and then Salt Lake proper.
Yeah, they're great clubs. They're fun. They're a lot of fun to work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, John told his experience with mobsters and Mormons, like the audition process and making it. So let's get your version of events. I mean, he didn't really say anything bad, but what happened with Mobsters and Mormons? How did you book it? What's your interpretation of everything?
I got the audition, I guess, through my agent. I don't really recall how it happened. I went in and the role was a New York mobster who has to go into the witness protection program, and they send him, of all places, to Utah, where he's got to fit in with the Mormons. So I thought that was a really clever premise for comedy. And the scene I auditioned with is in the movie. It's the mobster is stuck with a bunch of kids at a party and he has to tell them a story. So he tells them the three little pig story, but he changes it to their like three little mobsters. And the wolf comes by in a Cadillac and shoots up their house and threatens to break their legs. And all these little five-year-old kids are just staring at me, having no idea what the hell I'm talking about. And it was really funny. And I, you know, sometimes the material that you get for auditions, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not. And the better it is, the easier it is to audition. And that particular scene, I just got it. It was just a clever, funny comedy premise.
Right.
So I didn't have to really read it. I just kind of improvised it in the audition, basically, you know, along the lines of what he had written. And he said that's, you know, that was it. And hired me, and I got to go out to Utah for 2 or 3 weeks and do the movie. And we did, Scott Christopher co-stars in the movie with me. He plays the lead Mormon guy, mm-hmm. and he's really funny. Really, he's on, he's got a recurring gig on CBS right now on one of the CSI shows. Real straight role. But I thought we were very funny together. He's just such a straight arrow.
Yeah.
In the movie, and it gives you a lot of stuff to play off of. But the cast was great. The crew was great. We shot the whole movie in like 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks, really efficiently, really, you know, really fun. And I think the movie turned out really well.
It did. It's hilarious. And you don't have to be Mormon to get any of the, you know, all the jokes. It's really funny. It's really funny.
That's what I liked about it. You don't need to be, certainly there's 10% of the jokes that you won't understand if you're not a Mormon, but the rest of it, it's just a fish out of water story.
Yeah.
And, The other characters in the movie are so good and the acting is good and the premise is really good that it just works. It's weird that there's a mobster from New York who never says even hell.
Yeah.
The language is a little weird and there's no guns in it.
The F word. What was the word that it was changed to? Like fungo or
Yeah, well, because he's trying to stay hidden,
right?
My character knows he can't swear because that'll give him up, right?
Right.
So the fact that you can't swear in the movie works for the character. So he would get pissed off and almost swear a couple times and then catch himself. So you get a you get a joke out of that. So it all, you know, I think it worked. It was funny.
It's really funny. Like, and it holds up. I remember watching it at the time and thinking it was funny, but I think it was funnier when I rewatched it.
Yeah, Scott Christopher was visiting here out in LA a couple months ago. And he came by and we had dinner and we watched it again. And it was really fun. I forgot how funny it was.
Do you know when you nail it? Because he said the second you came in, he said within a minute or two, he was done auditioning. He knew it was you.
Yeah. I mean, here's what I know. I'll go in. And first of all, you got to make sure you're prepared. And mm-hmm. that's the work part. And then you go in and you do the read. And as I'm walking out, I know if I did my best or if I screwed up. And then if I know I did 100% of what I'm capable for that particular role, mm-hmm. then, you know, whatever happens, happens. They could be looking for a blonde guy or a skinny little guy or whatever.
Yeah.
So no matter how good I am, it's not going to matter. So that's my goal every time I read for something, is just to do the best version of the character for how I see it. And if the director and the producers see it the same way, then I get hired. If they don't, I don't. But, you know, and every once in a while, I don't do the best job I potentially could. And that's what pisses you off.
Yeah.
Like, I should have prepared more. I made the wrong choice, or I wouldn't hire me. Sometimes, you know,
right. And auditioning is brutal. It is brutal. If you've never auditioned for anything, I've done a couple, and it took me weeks to recover after them. It was awful. Like, can you explain the process of auditioning? Just how weird it is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it exposes the brutality of the world and show business in particular. You mm-hmm. go and you're sitting in a room with 15 to 20 other guys who sort of kind of look like you and sound like you, because they're all going for the same role. You're all preparing the same scene. You're all sitting there staring at each other, sizing each other up. Then one at a time, they call your name. You go into the room and there's either one person in a camera who's sort of paying attention to you, or that's the first audition. If you get past that, you go back and then there's the producer and there's maybe 5, 10, 20 people in the room. Then you have to do the thing again. And it's a very artificial situation. You're reading with, like, the other person that you're reading with on the other side of the camera will read all the other parts that aren't you, and you read that person. You know, you read your own character, so mm-hmm. you've got to react to them. One audition comes to mind. I was up for a role in a sitcom, and I'd made it all the way to the final casting session. Mm-hmm. So it was down to me and a couple other guys. And I get there and there's a little folding chair out in the hallway, and I can hear what's happening inside the room, and everyone's laughing and having a good time. And I'm thinking, oh, great. The room's going to be nice and warm. They're good laughers. Right. I got a funny scene to do. I'm going to be great. This is my role. I'm totally going to get it. I can feel it. Laugh, 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 laugh. Okay, thanks. The door opens and Eugene Levy walks out.
Oh!
And I'm like, oh. So I walked in. It was at Disney. There were like 15, 20 people there. Oh. Heads of the studio, heads of the network, everybody. So I go and they're like, all right, Mark, let's hear what you have to say. And the first thing I said was, if you guys hire me instead of Eugene Levy, you're idiots. And then I did the scene. I said, and then, you know, I did the best I could do, but hire me over Eugene Levy. Right.
You can't recover from that. You're toast.
Right. It's like, I got to pretend like I just didn't see one of the greatest comedy actors in the world walk out ahead of me. Sometimes you just get the short end of the stick and you got to have fun with it. You know, at that point, all you want to do is do a good audition so that, you know, when they're casting his best friend or something later on, they might think of you. Mm. But yeah, I cannot imagine. I mean, even like if they were making the Mark DiCarlo story, I'd still cast Eugene Levy instead of him. He would probably do a better job.
Oh my gosh. Do you have any horror stories about auditions? I love hearing about horror stories and comedy shows or anything, really.
Not about auditioning, because mm-hmm. I do it. And then by the time I'm back at my car, I've forgotten about it. And if they hire me, great. If you can't really get, it's, you know, it's like The Godfather. It's not personal. It's strictly business. I'm going to go in there.
Right.
And now that I've been on the other side of the table enough where I've been producing and hiring actors, mm-hmm. you know, when you're looking to hire someone, you're looking for someone that'll make your project as great as it can be. And if you have to, you know, people's right. feelings are going to get hurt because you don't pick them. That's, you can't really care about that. You want someone that's going to do the best job possible for you. So if I can be that for somebody else, great. If not, like I said, if I do the best I can do, then, you know, whatever happens. Right. I was doing, when I was doing my dating show Studs back in the 90s, I got invited to go out to the Catskills and do my stand up there out in the Catskill Mountains, which is, it was like a famous hotel called the Concord Hotel. Sinatra played there. Rickles played there.
Oh,
it had been there forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had never been to the Catskills. I knew that it was, you know, where New York Jews went for the summer to, you know, like right. that's what that was their thing. Like in right. people in Chicago, they go up to Wisconsin. You guys go up to, you know, you go skiing up right. in the mountains. Yeah. So this was a very, very homogenous group. It was like a dating weekend. So I get into this, I'm going to say 2,500, 3,000 seat arena theater. And it was unlimited drinks for the weekend. So picture 3,000 22 to 25 year olds sexed up on hormones and booze, ripped out of their minds. And I brought my friend Ted Davis with me, who was a very funny improviser as well. And we had, I was going to have him come out of the audience and do some funny stuff with me. So I start my act. He comes up out of the audience, pretending that he was just a regular audience member. People weren't listening. They're screaming and yelling. At one point, and it was a big proscenium stage, you know, probably 45, 50 feet across. Like you could do a Broadway show on this stage.
Wow.
I don't know how this happened. At one point, someone in a wheelchair appeared from the side of the stage. Someone else pushed them. They went screeching across the front of the stage, hit the lip of the stage, and then the person flipped into the orchestra pit.
Oh my gosh.
During my show. And then got up and walked away. So I think it's someone had just found a wheelchair and was screwing around, but it was pandemonium. It was like a Marx Brothers movie, like the end of a Marx Brothers movie. And after that, I was like, all right, well, my time's up. I gotta go. And it was the worst stand-up gig of my career.
Oh, and, that's painful. Did you ever find out who it was and why?
No, we got the hell out. We got out. There was a really nice female singer that was the opening act. And she's like, all right, you've been christened. And she took us out to some deli and we had pastrami at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was actually turned out to be a great night, but it was you know, I'm standing there telling jokes and boom, crash. It was.
What the heck?
But that's the beauty of show business, Mike.
Yes.
That's not going to happen to someone that's working in a cubicle or driving a bus. I like the unpredictability and the craziness that you have to put up with and sometimes get to enjoy.
It is. And it's fun for a story later on. It's not funny at the time.
Right. No, we were telling the story like that night, how hilarious it was. Because at that point, I mean, I knew when I walked out on the stage that they were too drunk to really pay attention, especially if you're doing stand-up. You know, you have to be listening to understand the setup joke.
Right.
And they weren't. They were just there to party and they thought they were going to see an episode of Studs. And that wasn't really what I was doing. I was doing comedy. And it was, it's a great story, basically. It was worth it for the story.
Free booze. Is it a thing they always do? So they were used to the pandemonium.
I think so. Yeah, it was not bizarre to them. I think the wheelchair thing was a little bizarre to them. But yeah, it was like an all-inclusive weekend. You come up and there's a bunch of single boys and a bunch of single girls and open bar and, you know, do the math. It was craziness. Right. It was craziness.
I can picture it all in my head. It's coming together nice. Yeah.
Yeah. The Concord Hotel, famous hotel. I mean, a band. They should have booked a band, not a comedian.
Right. Yeah. But music would be fine.
I was happy to be there.
You said you were doing a Travel Channel show. Was that like a foodie stuff,
yeah,
right?
It was called Taste of America. And I've been to over 400 cities.
Wow.
And, you know, every region, every place in America has a certain kind of food. And there are reasons why they have that kind of food. You know, steak is big in Texas because that's where the cattle is grown. Mm. And New Orleans is probably America's best food city because it's a port city. So there's constantly people coming and going from all over the world, a crucible of a bunch of different cultures mixing together. You've got African and Caribbean and French and Italian and Southern and regular American and South American, all cohabitating and mixing in one particular location. And the recipes, you know, poor people get very clever with food because they're hungry You know, if you're growing pigs and you have to sell the pigs to the rich people and all you have left are the intestines, you figure out a way to make them tasty and you turn them into chitlins and then you like them. I had a book on it's like a travel foodie book called A Fork on the Road, 400 Cities, One Stomach. And it's kind of my journal of my travels and the food and the people I met around the country and how, as different as we all are, there's a certain deep river of commonality that brings everybody together, and it's family and food and traditions. And even though the specific traditions vary from place to place, the fact that everybody has traditions is the same. And you just have to understand that, you know, a spaghetti dinner in Boston's North End is the same as Rocky Mountain oysters is in Denver. You eat it because that's what your grandmother made, and it's delicious because it's what your grandmother made, and it's what you grew up with, and it's from your part of, you know, Rocky Mountain oysters are the fried testicles of young calves because the cowboys ate every part of the cow, right? If you're out on the range and you're hungry, you eat the good parts of the meat, but you also find ways to eat the not so good parts of the meat because you need the protein to live. And if you got 15 kids out on the prairie somewhere, you got to make a little piece of meat stretch much farther than, you know, it was meant to. So
right.
The poor people in America or around the world really are always the inventors of the recipes because they have to be clever to stay alive.
Yeah, that's a good point. What's the weirder stuff, like the Rocky Mountain oyster, the testicles?
I had to. It tastes kind of like popcorn shrimp a little bit. Didn't really eat a lot of them. we were up in Madison, Minnesota, where they make lutefisk, which is white fish cured in lye, which is like battery acid.
Doesn't that decompose bodies?
It does. And it works on the fish, too.
And
yeah. But that, you know, back in the Viking days, when you were sailing around the world, you had to have protein that would keep. So by taking the fish and sticking it in this lye, it wouldn't spoil. It wouldn't go bad. That's where salted meats come from. You salt the meat, you pull the water out of it so it doesn't spoil. And one piece of meat can last 6 weeks. Like prosciutto is a ham that's cured the right way so it lasts for months instead of 5 days with regular food. So again, inventiveness is behind most of the best recipes in the world. New Orleans gumbo exists because you've got a whole bunch of hungry mouths to feed and you only have a little bit of sausage or a little bit of beef. You stretch it out with rice and butter and roux and flour because you had flour, you had butter because there were livestock around. You had a little bit of meat. So you get the rice and you can make, you know, a pound of meat can feed 40 people instead of, if you have a steak, it feeds one guy.
Right.
So that's the genesis of, I think, most of the best American recipes. But what we really tried to focus on in the show and in the book were the personalities and the people around America who are simultaneously all very, very, very different, yet share the same basic values and the same base, you know, they want a happy life. They want their family to be healthy and happy, and they want a good, productive job and have a good life. So everyone wants the same things. It's sad that at the moment there's so much acrimony in the world because there are so many people that just want everything. They don't want to share anything.
Right.
So, you know, it was very interesting. Five seasons, and I've continued with a travel podcast called A Fork on the Road. And the book keeps selling. So, you know, I love travel and, that's probably been the hardest part of the pandemic is not being able to get on a plane.
Yeah. So I guess you've kind of halted. So have you taken a little hiatus from doing the podcast?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, nothing to say, nothing to do. Right. And I do a television show in Chicago called Windy City Live. So I
three Emmys.
I haven't been able to go back to Chicago and do that either.
You know,
I've been doing everything by Zoom. So I'm looking forward to getting back and doing that. And
are you
and,
a regular on Windy City Live?
I was, yeah. But they stopped doing the show for a long time. We're just doing reruns. Then the hosts were doing the shows out of their houses. Now they're back in the studio, but there's no live audience. And all the guests are coming in via Zoom, I think in July. It's going to go back to somewhat normal. So I'll be able to get back to Chicago probably in July sometime and do some pieces and see some baseball games.
You do everything on Zoom with them now. And then before now you do, were like a correspondent. Is that kind of what you're?
Yeah. Yeah. I would go there once a month and record three or four pieces and then be on the show live the days that I was there. And then they would use my pieces while I was gone. And then I'd come back three or four weeks later and do it all over again. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary. We took Oprah Winfrey's time slot. So she went off the air on Friday on the ABC station there. And then we started on Monday. And,
How did that whole thing come about?
Well, she announced she was retiring and the station in Chicago is where she started, WLS TV in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They knew that that kind of show would work. So they decided to make a new one and they called it Windy City Live. And there's a male and female host, and then a couple correspondents, myself and Ro Khan, who's a radio personality in town. And it was a little more Regis and Kelly than Oprah. Mm-hmm. And people seem to dig it. I mean, you know, we've been on 10 years and no one's gotten beaten up yet.
You go.
That was a good barometer.
Right. Yes. That's a good way to test how well you're liked out there. You did a lot of man on the street stuff. I found a clip that is hysterical and I think you know which one I'm talking about. Can you explain a little bit what's going on and we can play a little piece of it?
Yes. Yeah. my gig would, I'd be out in the street doing, you know, if there was a new law passed or if someone was coming to town or if we had a funny idea where we wanted to interview people on the street in Chicago because everyone's super nice there. Mm-hmm. One time in the winter, I was walking freezing cold downtown and there was this homeless guy walking in front of me and about 10 feet in front of us, there was another homeless guy sitting there panhandling and the guy in front of me just had socks on and it was freezing. And as we got up to the homeless guy sitting down, The sitting down guy goes, "Hold on a second, brother," reached into his bag and pulled out a pair of shoes and gave the shoes to the other homeless guy and said, "Here, you need these more than me."
No kidding.
Now, would that happen in New York? No. Only in Chicago.
Wow, that's really cool.
It was very heartwarming. And I'm biased because I'm from there, but it's a great city. The people are wonderful typically. So I thought it would be funny to see how far Chicagoans would go to help me out. When I would go out into the city, we would have a remote truck and it's like a van with a little satellite dish on top of it. And it could beam whatever I was doing back to the station live. And we could do live remotes with a remote truck. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, you know, very ostentatious truck with WLS painted on the side. Everyone saw it, knew, oh my God, they're shooting some kind of TV thing here. So we were shooting something at the Bean one day and taping it. So we had shot it, we taped it, we were getting ready to go back to the studio and we still had a little time left in the day. And I'm like, you know what, let's pretend like we're going to go live to air and pretend like I'm supposed to interview an author or a celebrity and the celebrity doesn't show up. And I'm just going to walk up to people and say, please help me out. So I'm standing there with my mic, with the satellite dish, with the PAs running around frantic. They're going, 30 seconds to air, 30 seconds to air. So I grab this guy who's in shorts and sandals and a t-shirt. And I go, dude, you got to help me out. We're supposed to go live right now on the air. And there's a fashion designer that was supposed to meet me here. And he blew me off. Just pretend that you're him. The guy's name is Paco DiMartini. He was he's a fashion designer. And he did a big fashion show last night at McCormick Place. Just pretend to be him. I'll ask you questions. And just please, please help me out. And he goes, okay, 3, 2, 1, you're on.
All right. Here's a little bit of that. Here we go.
All right.
Can one of you guys pretend to be him? All right. His name's Paco DiMartini. He's a fashion designer. He had a show at McCormick Place last night. All right. Okay. So just
30 seconds.
All right. Just pretend to be him. Your name's Paco.
Okay.
Brian and Val, we're here at Millennium Park at The Bean, and we are talking to world-famous fashion designer Paco DeMartini. Paco, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
You had a great fashion show last night at McCormick Place. What was that like?
It was wonderful. It was awesome. A lot of people showed up, and a lot of great turnout.
Now, where do you get your inspiration from, and why did you decide to be a fashion designer?
Well, I like clothes and traveling the world, get a lot of ideas from different backgrounds and things like that. And
the camera pans down, and he's wearing flip-flops.
Yeah. Talking about fashion.
With that,
the big splash that you made last night at the show, and I don't think anyone, I mean, I'm not a fashion expert, obviously, but I don't think anyone has done this before. Where did you get the inspiration to combine stiletto heels and hefty garbage bag skirts?
Well, it was just something that came up looking at people. You see homeless people and things like that, and you get ideas how to use what's in the environment together to put it together.
And these inspirations, do they come to you, like, do you sit at a desk and draw? Do they come to you in the shower? Just take me through your inspirational process.
Some through the desk, some from walking around observing people. A lot of observation, what people like and what they don't like, and what people are looking for.
Do you see any cool fashion statements here at The Bean?
Yeah, there's a lot of cool fashion statements. People wearing different things, halter tops, shorts, different shirts. We gave different ideas for shirts on that.
And because you're such a great urban artist, you kind of combine these things in your work?
Yes.
Okay. So the show last night, huge success. I can't let you go without asking about what happened last year when the animal rights people boycotted your line. You made all the earrings, the necklaces, and the accessories made from puppy parts. Right. Now, you said you were trying to draw attention to animal euthanasia. Do you think it worked?
I think it worked, because more people are aware about animals and letting them live longer and stuff, and not putting them to sleep and letting them get a longer life, unless they really need to be put to sleep. I'm not an advocate for that.
Right.
But, I mean, everybody has a time, life, and everything, but it makes them more aware to take care of their pets and things like that.
You were actually booed off the stage last March in New York when the model came down the runway wearing severed puppy paws for earrings. What did that feel like?
It felt terrible because they missed the whole point of what I was trying to inspire them to see.
They missed the whole point of what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, he just went there. That is the essence of improvisation, too. He just yes-anded everything I said.
Oh,
he at no point did he go, oh, no, I can't. He was hilarious.
Oh, he was the best.
They just didn't understand my message, what I was trying to say. Yeah.
Right? And you kept getting more absurd as it goes on, and he was
and he stuck with it. Right, because Chicago people are good people, and they'll help you out. We gave him a vacation someplace, and, you know, we told him after the fact what had happened, and
cool.
We did that bit a bunch of times. It's a funny setup, and it's a very Chicago thing, but he just embraced it, and you know, if you think you're on live TV, you can't stop.
Right.
So
you should do a whole show like that. That would it's like kind of like Impractical Jokers. Yeah.
It's exactly like that. And you know, you just do it until you find someone that plays into it. And he was the first guy I picked. He just was in the right mood on the right day.
Right. And it looked like he had a big chunk of tobacco in his mouth also, which just adds to the visual.
No, he looked like, you know, a grungy visitor just visiting the city and walking around Chicago and having a good time, and just wanted to help out a stranger.
Oh, that is awesome. All right, so you're working on all these TV shows and everything. Now you're doing a new one, Boffo the Bear. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Yeah, I've partnered with, I've done cartoons for a long time. As you said, I play Hugh Neutron on Jimmy Neutron, Johnny Bravo. I've done a lot of other typical cartoons. And the way those work is you go in, you record your part, and then 9 months later, the animation is done, and then it goes on the air. I've partnered with the guy that designed all the animated effects for the Avengers movies and Polar Express and Computer Wizard. And he's got a system that we've developed together that can make a cartoon instant. So I sit with a motion capture suit on, and I'm photographed, and then it converts my human body into a bear body instantly. Holy and we do it live to air. So back in May of 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, we put this studio into my office here, and we started the Bafo the Bear show on YouTube. And every day I would interview celebrities, and Bafo rather would interview celebrities and take phone calls, and we did a game show and whatever we could think of to be funny live to air with a cartoon. And
right.
we got a lot of really, really good response from it. And now we're developing television shows and a digital streaming game show using this technology, both for Bafo and for other characters that we're creating. And it's really, it's feature film quality animation instantly. It's never been able to be done before. We're the only studio in the world that can do it.
Wow.
And it's combining my two things. It's improv, like right. we just heard, and cartoons, which has never been possible before. Typically, you know, it takes a year to make a cartoon. The Pinocchio right. movie, we've been working on it for 2 years. This is instantaneous to air, and it's super, super, super fun and funny, I think.
That's incredible. Is it? Do you wear one of those suits with all the green balls all over them?
It's evolved past that. This is, it's those... The ones with the green visible balls on it were an optical system where there were cameras. If you picture like a grain silo, right? Mm-hmm. Picture a virtual grain silo. So there's cameras in a circle around you, and it covers you in this volume, this cube. So every one of those little dots marks a joint on your wrist or your elbow, your knees or whatever. Now it's all electromagnetic. So instead of having a camera see it visually, it's picking up, it's like a little GPS tracker on your wrist, a different addressed one on your elbow, a camera on your face that maps it in three dimensions. So when you raise your cheek or you lower your lip or you blink your eyes, it's all captured. And then if you think of a marionette puppet, mm-hmm. you know, a string is attached to every part that moves. These are millions of electronic strings attached to each physical muscle in my body. And then the other end of that string is attached to the analogous muscle in this cartoon bear. So when I wiggle my finger, he wiggles his finger. When I wink, when I show my teeth, when I stick out my tongue, the bear does it in real time. It's been possible for about 10 years to do this, but it would take, you'd have to capture the data and then process it over several weeks to get the same effect.
Right.
My partner, Julian Sarmiento, has invented a system that does it instantaneously. And we're able to do it live to air. We're developing a Who's Line type show where it's going to be four cartoons instead of four people.
Oh.
And when you say, we're going to the North Pole, all of a sudden the background changes and you're at the North Pole. So it's very exciting, and it's kind of, you know, you see all these virtual influencers and things coming on. It's the next wave in entertainment, and I think we're kind of at the break of the wave.
That is incredible, the way that technology has changed, where you can do that instantaneously. Mm-hmm. How long does that take him to develop that whole thing?
Well, he's been working in this field for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's a factor of how fast can the computers be, how fat is the pipe that the data can travel, because you've got, you know, let's say a couple thousand data points that it's picking up on my face alone, let alone my body. Then that's got to go back to a computer. It's got to connect with the model of the bear and then make the bear do the same thing I'm doing, all within 2 to 3 milliseconds. So you can't even, it appears to be instantaneous. It goes up on a screen, or we can do it in a live theater with I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, Tupac Shakur appeared at Coachella on a stage. Yeah. And we can do that same technology where you'll see a cartoon bear walking across a physical real stage, interacting with people in real life.
So it's kind of like a hologram type thing that you're able to do.
We can do it on a screen or in a hologram, either way, yeah.
So are you going to do it with... like live stage shows as well?
Mm-hmm. We're doing live stage shows. We're doing a daily game app that's kind of like HQ Trivia, but better. We want to do a game show, a television game show, because that's real and it has to be live. Basically any format of content that you can think of, we can shoot it like a regular human and it comes out as a cartoon. We want to do a sitcom where the bear is married to a human woman, and it's fish out of water kind of thing.
Right.
The potential, I think, is pretty unlimited at this point, and we're still at the early stages of the technology. It's going to get faster and better and cheaper as we move along. So.
That's true.
I'm very excited to be working with them.
Well, and that's called Disruption Studios.
Yeah, you can see the best way to do it is just to go to YouTube and look up Boffo the Bear, one word, Boffo the Bear. And we've got about 200 videos there with celebrities and weird, funny stuff that I don't think you're going to see anywhere else. And if you do, let me know.
Do you guys have it patented?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And good luck trying to figure out how to do it. I mean, he's been doing, he did all the Avenger characters. The Avenger movies are 90% cartoon. Anyway, they're just realistic looking cartoons.
Right. So
he's got all that experience and he's able to distill it down for us in an instantaneous fashion. And it's pretty amazing.
That is incredible. Is that kind of the same thing that you did with the new Pinocchio you're doing? Or you did?
No, the Pinocchio and the Water of Life is traditional CGI animation. It's being done by a studio out of Barcelona called Asymmetric VFX. And that's why it's taken so long. We're talking about doing a television series with it. And if we do the TV series, we would do it with this motion capture stuff. But the film we did old school style, and we've got a really great cast. We've got Tom Kenny as Pinocchio. He's the voice of SpongeBob, and Rob Paulsen and Maurice LaMarche, who are Pinky in the Brain, and Phil LaMarr, the Green Lantern, and Fred Tatasciore, who plays the Hulk, and Susie Nakamura from Avenue 9 and Modern Family, and who else is it? It's the 27 Yankees of voiceover talent is in this movie. It's really really, we're lucky to have them. And as we were talking at the beginning of the interview, we recorded everything with everybody all in the same room at the same time. Everyone gets in their own little isolation booth, but you can see each other. And it really helps the comedy. We have Riker Lynch from Glee and Dancing with the Stars. He's a bona fide young rock star. He plays the singer among the puppets, and Jim Turner, and a lot of great people in it.
That's going to be a lot of fun. And that's going to come out later this year?
Comes out at Christmas, and then the TV series will start probably third quarter of 22.
That's awesome. Congratulations on everything. This is really exciting stuff, man.
It is. It's cool to kind of be able to take my weird set of talents and blend them all into one similar project. Usually I'm doing improv or doing a cartoon or doing something else, especially Boffo and Pinocchio to a greater extent because of the writing. I'm able to kind of do all the things that I like doing all at once, which is very gratifying. And like I said, we've been lucky because we've been able to continue working during the pandemic, unlike a lot of other people I know. And so it has been far less stressful than it probably should have been.
When you're all together recording and you're all in your sound booths, is some of the animation done while you guys are doing the voices, or how does that whole thing work?
No. If you're lucky, they'll have a picture of the character for you. We had art for all the actors. We showed them, it's called a lead sheet. It shows the character smiling, angry, moving, shows you his size compared to other characters in the cast. So you have a visual interpretation or a visual idea of what the character looks like, which helps you come up with what you think the voice should sound like. And then everyone sits in their spot and we start at the beginning and we create what's called the radio play. And we record it scene by scene by scene. We did what we did with Neutron. Typically with a Jimmy Neutron episode, we'd record a scene as written on the page. Mm-hmm. And then we would do a crazy pass where everyone was free to do whatever what they wanted, say whatever they wanted, improvise whatever, and make it as funny as they want. And on the Neutron show, I would say 20 to 30% of the final show ended up being stuff that was improvised because we had a cast of people that were really good at that. Robbie Paulsen and Jeff Garcia and Megan Cavanaugh and Candy Milo. Especially as the show went on, the better you know your character, the more you can think of things that he would say that maybe isn't on the page. So we did the same thing with Pinocchio. We'd record a scene as written, and then we would let these guys who are masters at it you know, go for it and do a crazy pass. And a lot of the stuff that they invented ends up in the movie. I've also been on shows where I get yelled at for changing a word or a phrase or something. Oh. And I, you know, that's fine. It's your movie. But I always figure, hey, we're paying you for the day. If I can also get you to write some hilarious jokes that I wasn't funny enough to think of, I'll take it. You know, it doesn't matter. That's the Second City training. It doesn't matter who thinks of it. If it makes the piece better, everyone's going to look better. And I think Johnny Carson was the king of that. Carson wasn't always the funniest guy on his show, but he made it so that whoever was the funniest guy really shined. And then the next day, you didn't talk about the Robin Williams show. You'd say, did you see Carson? Robin Williams was on. And it's how Carson interacted with them and improvised with them that made it so great. So we were happy to hire the right people and let them do their thing, you know?
That's such a good point. Have you been watching that, the history of late night? I think it's on CNN maybe, Sunday nights?
Yeah.
Where the comics were talking about that he would just do the slightest little thing. Johnny Carson would do the slightest thing, but it would make the joke 20 times better, and it wasn't to get the attention on himself. It was to help enhance the joke.
Right, because he knew.
Yeah.
First of all, Midwestern guy, so he has that kind of frame of reference, but he knew that the point was to have a funny show. Now, right. You take a look at Jay Leno, who was his successor, who was a brilliant stand-up, but in my opinion, didn't understand what made that show tick. And Jay was always trying to get the topper, to get the funniest joke out of a series of jokes. And I don't think it works as well. Letterman was more in the Carson mold, where he would egg people on and set them up for jokes, you know, set them up with straight lines so that the guests could get the big laugh. If Tom Hanks is on your show, and every time Tom Hanks is on your show, he kills, Tom Hanks is going to want to come back on your show.
That's true. Yeah.
Right. And you're feeding them. It's, you know, again, it's back to the music of comedy. You have to be in sync with the person that you're working with. And when you are, magical stuff happens that you can't plan for. You can't repeat. One of the things I do for Windy City Live is I do the movie junkets. So when movies come out, we go and we interview the stars of the movies. Steve Carell's a friend of mine from Second City, and we used to play on a hockey team together. So we were doing an interview with him when his Burt Wonderstone movie came out.
Oh, yeah.
The one about magic in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. So I got there, and it was the end of the day. He had been sitting there all day answering the same three questions from the movie reviewer from Houston, and the guy from Dallas, and the guy from Seattle, and it's just mind-numbing. Right. So at the beginning of the interview, I just said, listen, I'm going to be the worst interviewer you've ever had, and just slowly get more and more and more pissed off as the interview goes along. And it was hilarious because he tried to be nice, and I was so horrible and so bad. He gets pissed at me. He starts insulting me. And I just sent the tapes to my producer in Chicago, and she lost her mind. She's like, what did you do? And then I sent her the afterwards of us laughing and making the plan. And it's one of my favorite pieces from Windy City Live, because it's all, you know, improvised weirdness that you're not going to see anywhere else.
Right. Did you do, that was your forte? Like, you were the one that was sent to do all those junkets, as you called it?
Yes. Yeah. And that's a weird thing. You hole up in a hotel. The stars are in a hotel for typically a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And every interviewer gets 4 minutes in the room. You walk in, you sit down, they start a clock. When 4 minutes are up, no matter where you are, they interrupt you and they kick you out.
Wow.
So you have to answer the questions. And because of that format, 95% of the questions the star gets asked are the same 4 minutes, then the same the next 4 minutes. And everyone... Oh. All the interviewers think they're being so clever, asking them, what did you think about your character? So I always try and ask them about stuff that that isn't particularly germane to what the movie is, and it perks them up. Hugh Jackman was another really fun guy I interviewed I think it was the musical that he did, the movie musical.
Greatest Show?
Greatest Show, right. And I said, all right, I did the interview with him. And then my boss, Marlene, was a huge Hugh Jackman fan. So I said, Hugh, and she had just been diagnosed with a very subtle form of cancer, which she ended up beating, and she's fine. So I had just gotten that news this morning. And so we finished the interview and I go, excuse me, guys, if I could have a couple more minutes, Hugh, my boss is a big fan of yours. Can we make a funny tape that'll make her laugh? I'm just going to ask you a question. And every time you start to answer, I'm going to continue asking another question so you can't get a word in edgewise. And he was hilarious. I'd ask him a question. He would take a breath and start to answer. And I go, because really what I'm trying to say here, Hugh, is, and I didn't let it. So it goes on for 2 minutes. And all he says at the end of the, and I go, so blah, 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 blah. So is the movie good? And he goes, yes, it's a good movie. Thank you. Bye-bye. And I sent her that tape and she blew her mind. But he was a sweetheart and what a super talented dude he is. Holy what can't smokes. He do?
Dude, right? Holy
and cow. He played along and he was brilliant and hilarious. And those are the times when it's fun to be in show business, when people realize that they're lucky to be where they are. Mm-hmm. It's always a combination of talent and skill. I know a lot of incredibly talented people that are broke. You gotta get a nice break, and the people that stay in touch with that and can have fun with their celebrity. Tom Hanks is another guy who's I've had a chance to hang out with him multiple occasions, and he's exactly who you want him and think he is.
Really?
Exactly. He's the nicest, most normal. I know I'm super famous. I'm having fun with it, but I'm not a dick.
Oh, yeah, that's good to know.
Just exactly what your impression of what you think Tom Hanks is who he actually really is in real life.
Because he seems like a cool cat, man.
Total cool cat, works hard, very, very talented, and enjoys the fact he doesn't pretend that he's not famous. Bill Murray does the same thing, goes around and talks to people just randomly, knows he's giving them a thrill, and then he moves on to the next thing, and it's... I think a great way to handle the weirdness of fame.
That's really cool. There's a documentary about Bill Murray doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
a good movie.
Yeah. And I had a whole new respect for Bill Murray after watching it, all the stuff that he does just to make people's day. And it's so little for him, right. But it's something they have for the rest of their lives. It was so
exactly.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, and he's another Second City guy out of Chicago. Billy is.
Yeah. Was he around the same time? You were?
No, he's a lot older than me. He was, he got to SNL in 76, I think.
Oh, okay.
So he was early 70s in Chicago. But yeah, I got 10 minutes to kill. I'm going to walk into this wedding and dance with the bride because I'm Bill Murray and I can go wherever I want and do whatever I want and everyone will be happy to see me.
Yeah.
And he embraces that freedom. Because the dark side of that is everywhere he goes, people know it's Bill Murray and they want to talk to him or, you know, hang out with him or whatever. So he kind of turns it to his advantage and, gives people a great story.
Yeah.
I'm standing there pissing at Wrigley Field and Bill Murray cycles up next to me and we talk for 2 minutes and then he's gone. And I have a Bill Murray story to tell.
Yes. One of my favorite ones was... it was at a house party and the guy was telling it, he was in the kitchen and Bill Murray came in, saw a bunch of people there. He came in, started doing the dishes and then just left. That's it.
Right. Right.
That's all he did.
Anybody else does that, you call the police right. And he goes to jail. Bill Murray does it and it makes it into a story in a movie because he's Bill Murray.
Right. Oh my gosh. That's so cool, man. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking some time and hanging out with me.
No, Mikey, it's been a blast. I've enjoyed it. And it feels like I'm back in show business now. The world's coming back to normalcy. It's, right. It's a great feeling.
Where can people check out all the stuff? Is it markdecarlo.com? Is that where you update everything?
Yeah, markdecarlo.com is my website. You can follow me on social. I'm Mark DeCarlo TV on Instagram and Mark DeCarlo on Twitter. And check out Boffo the Bear on YouTube.
All right. Well, we would do that, and we'll link to whatever we can, I guess, on our Facebook page. But, man, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you taking the time and the stories and just everything. Thanks so much, Mark.
Mike, you're a great interview. It's really fun talking to you, and continued success with your show. I know you're a beast in the podcast world, and now I know why.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind. Mark DiCarlo, thanks so much, man. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.